Genesis 4, starting in verse 17. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. When he built a city, he called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad fathered Mehujael, and Mehujael fathered Methushael, and Methushael fathered Lamech. And Lamech took two wives, and the name of the one was Adah, and the name of the other Zillah. Adah bore Jabal, and he was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Nahamah. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, Lamech's is 77-fold. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel. And for Cain killed him. To Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. At that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. Let me ask you a question. Would it be great if we could learn lessons, if we could form deep convictions without learning the hard way? Would it be great if you could learn a lesson, if you could actually not just understand it, but learn it and have a deep conviction about it without having to learn it the hard way? Would that be great? If you're like me at all, you would think, yes, that would be the case. That would be a wonderful thing. And most parents teach their children. They try to teach their children. If you can learn the lesson from me, that'll be so much better than having to learn it the hard way. So most parents try to convince their kids that it would be a great thing if you could learn a lesson and if you could develop a very deep conviction without having to learn it the hard way. John Newton thought that this was the case too with his own spiritual situation, his spiritual life. He prayed that God would help him grow in every grace, and he thought that in some favored hour, God would appear and grant his request all at once, and by his love's constraining power would subdue his sins and then give him rest. But instead of this kind of zap, your sanctified approach, that didn't happen for Newton. Newton goes on to sing about how God made him feel the hidden evils of his heart. And God showed him his sin so much more. And why? Newton cried to God. Why are you blasting me like this? Will you pursue my soul to death? And the Lord replied to John Newton. And he said, this is the way that I answer prayers for grace and faith. Because these inward trials I'm employing so that from self and pride I can set you free, so that I can break the schemes of worldly joy, so that you will seek your all in me. And that's what we're going to see in this chapter of Genesis, but it's also in the next couple following chapters of Genesis. Man's fall into sin, on the one hand, is not very pretty. And sin is exposed. And the text is intending to bring out the consequences of sin when it's left so far as possible to itself. For, as one of my favorite theologians, Gerhardus Voss, says, had God permitted grace freely to flow out into the world and to gather great strength within a short period, then the true nature and the consequences of sin would have been very imperfectly disclosed. And you all know that the flood happens in Genesis chapter 6. I think you all know that. Children, if you don't know that, that's where the flood comes in, Genesis chapter 6. That narrative starts. And that's an early part in the Bible. There's a lot of sin that builds up in Genesis 3, 4, and 5, getting us to Genesis chapter 6, because God is demonstrating to the world, to show to the world, the consequences and the deadliness and the darkness of sin. So we can know it. In the New Testament, God says that's why he brought the law. The whole purpose of the law is so that he could shut up everything under sin so that he might show mercy. So you can see it. And this is why in the New Testament, when Christ comes into the world, in Galatians chapter 4, Paul calls that God came, Jesus came in the fullness of time. It was at just the right time so that sin is clearly illustrated and that redemption is fully appreciated. And if you were living in the time of Cain and Abel and Seth, of course you would have wanted Jesus to come then. Of course you would have wanted that. Abraham would have said, that would be great if we could just end this situation here and Jesus could come and we could all go to heaven. But God was doing things the way he knew was necessary to fully demonstrate the darkness and the sinfulness of sin and the goodness of grace. So there's this contrast that runs throughout the Bible, and especially in Genesis, of the darkness of sin and the enmity toward God that worldliness is. Now again, as we talked about last week, the Bible really focuses on evil coming from inside the heart, not outside the heart. It's the wickedness within. And you see the progress of sin is rampant when unchecked by the hand of God, because self is an insatiable monster. Self is an insatiable monster. It's not the evil goblin that's out in the world that's coming to come and eat you up. It's you are the evil goblin. You have the insatiable desire for more and more sin. It's inside of us all. And what we'll see in our text this morning is the battleground of the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent unmasks the hidden evils of our own hearts, and it assaults our souls in every part if we read Genesis correctly. But it also calls attention to God's faithfulness in continuing the line of the seed of the woman. So just to be sure that you all understand, the picture in Genesis is going to be just about as dark and as black as it can be, but the light never gets completely snuffed out. God is going to make sure that that's the case. And sometimes in human history, people have to go through excruciating difficulty, very dark and black times. I think sometimes around World War II, there were some very dark and black times. And there's probably been humans who have suffered so much more than we have ever understood suffering could be. And they've been Christians, and they've looked out and they've said, is there any light in this world? Who knows what the North Korean Christians are feeling right now? Or some of the Chinese Christians now that the government is really coming down on Christianity. And every day they wake up. And it can look so dark, but I believe those Christians can still sing with you and I, great is thy faithfulness. Morning by morning, new mercies I see. But there's a massive contrast in the battle between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, so that sin can be fully exposed and grace can be fully understood. Now, in this protection of the seed of the woman, God is bringing all of his people to the fullness of time, because God is going to protect the seed of the woman till Christ wins the final victory. We read from Thessalonians 5, God is faithful. He will surely accomplish it. God is the one who is orchestrating human history to the glory of himself, to the glory of Jesus Christ. He is not going to allow the enemy to win. That's why Jesus can promise the gates of hell are not going to prevail against the church. But there will be times when it looks like that's what's going to happen. Genesis chapter 4 is one of those times leading up to Genesis 6. Naturally, our text divides along the two family lines and what they produce, but the narrative bulk is in the line of sinful Cain. But there is powerful hope shining through Seth, even though it's only two verses in what we're going to cover this morning, and may seem like a faint glimmer. But first, I want to address the line of Cain and how Cain's love of self produced a culture of death. Now, remember back in verse 13 of chapter 4, which we talked about last time, when Cain is cursed by God, Cain is distraught. And he's thinking that his punishment was too great for him. He couldn't bear it. So when we get to verse 17 and it says Cain knew his wife and she conceived, bore Enoch, and then he built a city, it seems like Cain is being rebellious against God. Because remember, part of the curse that God gave Cain was that he would be a wanderer and a fugitive all his life. But instead, Cain settles down and builds a city or a walled stronghold. John Bunyan says that men who are shut out of heaven will yet use some means to be honorable on earth. And when he has this son, Cain thinks to build this city. Why do you build a city? Why build a city? You have a son. Well, the Bible gives us a really good answer. In many places, people build cities to make a name for themselves. But you don't even need the Bible to know that that's the case. Why do you build a city today? Why do people go to the city? They go to make a name for themselves. I mean, everybody knows about Frank Sinatra, and everybody knows you're going to go to New York. Why are you going to go to New York? Because you make it there, you can make it anywhere. New York, New York. Yeah, you go to the city, and you go to the big city. You want to make a name for yourself. None of this out in the field and the rural patches where you make a name for yourself there, and only five people know your name. Then you go to the city, and you say, hey, I'm Drew. Everybody looks at you like, so what? Who cares? But you go to the city, you go to the big city, and you have a name, everybody pays attention. That's why a lot of people who are clamoring for their name in big lights, they can't stay stationary in rural places or in suburban places. They want to go where the city is to make a name for themselves. Renown. Cain didn't want to be forgotten. Much like sinful Absalom, and we did this recently in the evening services, how Absalom had lost all his children. He didn't have a kid, so he erected a gigantic stone, a big pillar, and then he named it after himself. He gave it the name of Absalom in remembrance of him. Or like the descendants of Cain, which maybe we'll come back to later on at the Tower of Babel. They build a gigantic city, a big tower. Why? The Bible is very clear, to make a name for themselves. And speaking of cities, St. Augustine wrote a great book, and it's one of his most well-read books. It was called The City of God. And in The City of God, Augustine has a great definition for sin. This is how he defines sin. He speaks it in Latin. Homo incurvatus in se. And that literally means sin is man curved in on himself. Incurvatus in se, in curving in on yourself. And I think he's right. I think this is a biblical definition because the Bible defines sin always as focusing on yourself, always choosing yourself over God, over others, always placing yourself in the center. Always. So Augustine argued in his book, The City of God, that there are two cities. There's the city of God and there's the city of man. And we can be part of both of those cities. But the thing that distinguishes you in which city you're part of is all about heart. Love to God or love of self. So if you're going into the grocery store and you're taking things off the grocery store aisles, you can be part of the city of God or the city of man. Being part of the grocery store doesn't tell you which city you're in. It's your love, your pursuit that tells you that. So if you're throwing things in your cart because you're insatiable for your own lust and your own greed and your own gluttony, well, you're part of the city of man. If you're there at the grocery store because you're going to make a meal for others and you're going to try to serve them because you love God, well, then you're part of the city of God. Do you see how that works? How Augustine is saying there's the two cities, and what determines them is the heart. Martin Luther later expands on Augustine's idea of incurvitus in se in his assault on a religious person who's curved in on himself. So even in religion, Luther argues that humanity seeks its own delight through religion rather than God himself. Luther knew that even pious religious people can be curved in on themselves, because it's very possible to delight yourself as you do religious activities and focus on yourself rather than God, whom you're supposedly worshiping. Even when we do good things, even when we help the poor, even when we enter into friendships, or when we come to church, or do a Bible study, or try to obey the Ten Commandments, in the flesh, in the city of man, it's always about you. One pastor said, you always relate to God. You have no option about that. Everybody relates to God. But sin determines how you relate to God and others, that it's only going to be in such a way and to such a degree that it furthers your own agenda. That things are going to go your way. That it's going to give you the right self-image or have you be considered the way that you want to be considered by other people. And as soon as religion becomes costly, as soon as relationships with God and other people becomes very costly, then we want to get out of it. And why? Because even when it looks like we're serving God and other people, we're actually serving ourselves. And if we're honest with ourselves this morning, if I am honest, I'm not pointing the finger at anybody out there, all 10 fingers pointed here at me. Often when I pray, incurvitus in se, I'm curving in on myself. What do I want? What do I want to get out of this? Often when I help somebody, even, all 10 fingers are here. I'm not pointing at any of you. I'm trying to get something out of it. That's a great struggle. The struggle of self, and self is insatiable. It can never get enough. That's how insidious sin is. Remember, one of the main points of the narrative is to show us the blackness of our sinful hearts. God is going to say about humanity in just a few chapters, which we're not going to get to for a while, but in just a few chapters, God is going to say about humanity, their thoughts are only evil continually. I regret that I made them. When Cain builds a city, we see the design of Satan and the deceitful heart of man to labor to quiet a guilty conscience, not by faith in the blood of Christ, not by faith in the coming serpent-crushing power of the seed of the woman, but by making ourselves overly busy in the worldly things, by getting ourselves all kinds of jobs to do and tasks to be employed in this world that will distract us from the love that God has for us, but also the fear that we have that self will not be served because we want to promote self. So that's the first thing in verse 17 and 18. Cain is building a city, but then in verse 19 through 22, notice how sin the insatiable desire of sin starts recording for us Lamech, who is the seventh generation of Cain. And originally, when God put Adam and Eve in the garden, he told them to be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. And many commentators point out that Cain having a son shows that God is still commonly gracious to all people. Even wicked people still have children. And Lamech is now, he comes on the scene, and the first thing that we learn about Lamech in verse 19 is that he took two wives. And do you think, is this part of God's common grace that he doesn't condemn Lamech for the two wives? God had told Adam and Eve to be fruitful and garden and be multiplied. He told them to make the rest of the world a garden like Eden was. And they were supposed to take the raw materials of that God had given them and work the ground in such a way to produce something that would serve God and serve others, even serve the rest of creation. And you can think of it like this. God created life, but he employed man in rearranging and cultivating what he created in order to create culture. A culture was going to be built around what man was creating with what God had already created. Man doesn't have the ability to speak out of nothing. Ex nihilo. Here comes a Bible. Bible. No, I can't do that. I can take what God has created, and then I can make a sermon out of what God has created. God's the original creator, but it's interesting that God, in giving his commission to Adam and Eve, was asking them to take what he's created and be creative with it. But what do gardeners do? They till the land and soil so that they can produce fruit and vegetables and things that will serve other people and give them food. Adam and Eve would be creators in that sense, not by making new stuff out of nothing, but by using God's stuff in a living and sustaining way. Life through service. And that's the meaning of true culture, according to God. But look what we have here in the line of Cain. Instead of culture being life through service, we see a culture of death. And the service of self, which results in defiance and indulgence. So Lamech married two women, and Genesis 2:24 had said the original plan was for man to have one wife, to leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, not wives. Polygamy is definitely not the design of marriage ever in the Bible. One Jewish scholar said that you can read the Old Testament and you aren't reading the Old Testament correctly if you don't see that one of its major points is to show that polygamy is an absolute disaster. I've had people tell me that, hey, the Old Testament doesn't condemn polygamy. Maybe it's not that big of a deal. God didn't seem to be so upset with Abraham and all these people, multiple wives and their concubines and all that stuff. So maybe we just make too big of a deal out of it. But you've got to be kidding me. If you've read your Bible, if you've read the Old Testament, every single person who has multiple wives has got a disaster on their hands. The whole point of the narrative of King David, as he multiplies wives to himself, he multiplies problems. And that's not to say that women are bad and multiplying wives is bad. Just because the women are bad, it's to say that David is sinning. He was the problem. And Lamech is the first one. He's the seventh generation from Cain. And he does it in defiance to God. Because it's insatiable. One wife is not enough to defy God with. I need two. I need more. So we should learn to read from Genesis 4:19 all the way through Revelation 21:21 that polygamy is the disastrous incurvatus in se. It's man curving in on himself. Along with adultery and other sexual sins, man is curving in on himself. Listen to what Paul goes so far as to say in 1 Thessalonians. He says, "This is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality, that each one of you know how to control your own body in holiness and honor, not in the passions of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God, and that no one transgress or wrong his brother in this manner, because the Lord is the avenger in all these things. As we told you beforehand, and now warn you solemnly." And I want to be frank here, especially with men and young men, that sexual sin is a big deal, and so is pornography. Pornography is not a victimless crime. Pornography is curving in on yourself. It's curving away from God's desires and God's design and curving in on yourself. Serving yourself sexually defrauds your brother, the Bible says, and God will certainly avenge. It's part of the same culture of death flowing from the seed of the serpent. And so we have Cain producing a culture of defiance and sexual indulgence, which leads to death. Maybe one of the people that Lamech hurt, that he's boasting about in his song, maybe one of the persons was his brother that he took their daughter as his wife. But before we get to verse 23 to talk about the death that he produces, notice in verses 20 and 21 and 22, the children that are born to Lamech. First you have Jabal. He was the keeper of livestock. His name means increase. And so there's a picture here of great production. Verse 21, we have Jubal, who is the brother, and he's the father of music and musical instruments. His name, as you probably know, is where we get the word jubilee and jubilant. And he's the product of Joel Osteen, your best life now. Relax and enjoy life. But the third brother, Tubal-Cain, makes technology possible by creating forging tools, and all three brothers are not employed in bad things. The Bible is not trying to say that music is bad or instruments are bad or farming is bad. What the Bible is pointing out here is God's common grace. Even in the sinful, wicked world of Cain and Lamech and his descendants, he gives them production. He allows them to build. They have skills that were supposed to be used for the betterment of mankind and the production of godliness. They were supposed to be used like Adam and Eve's gardening was supposed to be used to create things that would help sustain life for other people and make life enjoyable and better. It's interesting, too, their sister's name means beautiful. And the sense is that Cain and his descendants were at home in this world and all was prosperous for them. They're like the wicked that Asaph complains of in Psalm 73. Everything they did seemed to work out for them. I want you to just keep that in your mind and put that on pause because we have to move on. But it's important to see the culture that's in contrast to what God had planned for Adam and Eve. It's now coming from Cain and from Lamech and his descendants. Okay, so we have this culture of polygamy and defiance and sexual indulgence, but we also have another hallmark of the culture of Cain in the culture of death, which is death itself, violence. And so in verse 23, it's been called the Song of the Sword when Lamech comes boasting to his two wives, and he's saying if even a kid so much as scratches him or bruises him, he's going to take his head off, literally. That's what Lamech is boasting. That's what his song is about. When he says, if Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech says 77 times. Seven is a symbolic number. It's a number of perfection in the Bible. And therefore, to say, I will be avenged 77 times, or seven times 70, this is a hard passage to translate. Either one, I think it works well. But Lamech is trying to say this, I will never give up my revenge. I will never lay aside my anger. I will never, ever, ever forgive anybody for ever wronging me. I am an insatiable murderer. My sin will never be quieted. And he seems to be excited about the fact that Cain was able to get away with murder, and now he's saying, now I am going to get away with murder. He seems to be so defiant that God protected Cain with this mark, and Cain needed that because Cain was afraid, but Lamech is saying, I will protect myself. I'm going to avenge myself on anybody who even so much as scratches me. It's hard to understand Lamech's mindset in his song, whether he's confessing a sin that he's already done or he's saying this is something that I will do. But most see his song as a wild boast and a confession. So if so, the narrative is showing how quickly sin degenerates in man and the power that sin will exert in trying to master their rebellion against God. But it's interesting, we know from our own experience, we know from history, how blood guilt is a very hard thing to deal with. Shame is something that people have a hard time contextualizing in their mind when they've committed the sin of murder. In warfare, soldiers oftentimes have post-traumatic stress syndrome if they've killed people. Having their blood on their hands is a scary thing. William Shakespeare famously wrote Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. She murders somebody, and what's the rest of her life? Misery, because she can't get the blood off of her hands. She keeps seeing the blood on her hands. But Lamech curves in on himself, and he tries to find resource in himself by increasing his rage and his arrogance. No wonder James says that the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And can you see how the love of self produces a culture of death? God's common grace may allow for men to thrive in this world and have all the instruments they need to make a good and beautiful culture. But if God is not the object of our pursuits, man will curve in on himself, and death will reign instead of life. Food will poison instead of edify. Art will degrade into dissonance, and tools will be fashioned instead of to help build things. Tools will be fashioned to be implements of death and war, because we live in a never give up, dog eat dog pursuit of self world. And you could see this with almost any company, too, that starts off with a good idea. Oh, I'm going to produce this thing for some other person. I'm going to be generous because we all need this thing. And then before long, people are killing themselves over it. It could be water. Produce clean water for people who need clean water. And as we curve in on ourselves, we start down the path of a culture of death. But the narrative is not all blackness and sin. I hope that that kind of paints a dismal picture for you, because that's the point. God is trying to show us how dismal sin is. But the narrative is not all blackness and sin, and it can't be, because the Bible is the story of redemption, after all. And so even though the emphasis is on the wickedness of sin, the point of our narrative is still redemptive. In this battle between the seeds, there's hope for the seed of the woman, because God always remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. And so we break from the ungodly line of Cain and now consider the godly line of Seth, and how Seth's faith produces a suffering service. So it's very interesting that Cain and Lamech and his descendants are wicked and producing a culture of death, but they don't seem to be suffering. You get that, right? In the text, hopefully you see that. They don't seem to be suffering. Remember Psalm 73? Asaph's like, what's up with the wicked? They're wicked, but everything seems to be going good for them. Similar here. So look in verse 25 and 26, these last two verses. Eve names this new son Seth. Now, Eve had once before expressed faith in God's promised seed when she named Cain, her firstborn. But he turned out to be not what she was expecting. She was so confident in her flesh that she thought Cain's brother was vain and a vain addition. He didn't need him, a needless breath. But now the text tells us that all the details, I'm sorry, now got ahead of myself a little bit. I have this little point about all these people that kind of show up, wives and cities, and Genesis is one of those places where atheists or people who don't believe the Bible, they like to go to Genesis and say, hey, what's the deal with Cain's brothers and sisters? Are they all intermarrying? Is that wrong? And the answer is yes, they did have intermarriage at the time, and no, it wasn't wrong at the time. But the Bible doesn't give us all the details of everything that's going on, and that's okay. It, just like Seth may not have been the third son born to Adam and Eve. It's just another son. It follows. She had many other children that were born to her, the Bible tells us, and they followed their older brother Cain. So that when there's a city and Cain makes a city, there's lots of people to populate that city. Now, I don't think it was hundreds of thousands, but It was more than two. There was people there. Time has passed. How, it's obvious that Seth is not the third son of Eve, but she had borne many other children. Now, Eve's faith is revived, though, when she has Seth. And this is interesting because there's a culture of death around them. Adam and Eve, as I've said last time, are in the covenant of grace. I believe they were believers. They were saved. But all their children are turning out rotten. The one child that they had that was good got killed by the other. So Eve is the mother of all the living. She's having lots of babies. And they're starting to grow up. And they're like, hey, we like Uncle Cain. We like him. Brother Cain, I guess it would be. Some of them are saying Uncle Cain. And they're following after him. Poor Adam and Eve. Surrounded by a culture of death. But now Eve's faith is revived. And her words are, behold, another seed. A seed to stand in Abel's place. Therefore, she calls his name Seth, and Seth means to be set or put, or maybe even better, appointed, as namely in the room of Abel, to stand up where he had died, to defend the truth against the army and the power of Cain. Paul says this of himself in the New Testament. He says, I am set or put for the defense of the gospel. And so Seth, as far as can be gathered, was the first to put a check to the outrage of Cain and his company. You see, the fall of man into sin is producing a whole culture of death, and every production of Adam and Eve is going in that direction. Original sin is real, and Adam and Eve knew it. But then there's hope. Seth is born, and I believe Eve could see and knew by God, supernaturally, that Seth was not going to go in the direction of sin and Cain. It's interesting. Here, we should say this is helpful for us, and it's also a corrective to persecutors. A lot of times, persecutors believe if you just snuff out the people that are proclaiming the gospel, then we'll put an end to it. We'll quiet everything. But when you've cast down your 10,000s of Christians and when you've tried to smash truth to the ground, there's always yet another Seth to be born. God will always put another in the place of the wicked attempts to persecute the church. Have they ever been successful? No. Even though they've killed millions and millions. I was reading this morning about the averages in from 1990 to 2007 of Christians killed. I think it was yearly 160,000 a year. That was the average from 1990 to 2007. 160,000 Christians a year around the world are killed, martyred for the faith. I know we're in America and we're all asleep and we think, oh, you don't die for being a Christian. Yes, you do. The world is trying to kill off Christians. Just recently, there was huge massacres of Christians in Africa. Maybe you heard a little bit about it. But as sure as there are killing Christians, God is raising up Seths, putting them in their place. The gates of hell will not prevail against the church. Indeed, in verse 26, it goes on to talk about Seth's son, continuing the line of the godly. It's wonderful that Seth is born, but if it's just one man, you're still pretty scared, and the Holy Spirit is going to go out of his way to say that the line of Seth is going to continue the seed of the woman, because it doubles Seth's name in the birth of the son. But to Seth, to him was born a son. It's like the Holy Spirit is slapping us in the face. He's saying, pay attention. Cain's descendants and Cain's life, it's big and it's scary, but Seth has a kid. Seth has an Enosh. And it's like one Puritan said, our faithfulness to the truth shall be no hindrance to the flourishing state of our offspring. Take them either for fleshly or spiritual seed of God's servants, but sons, especially in the latter sense, if we truly stand by the word of God, shall surely be born unto us. In connection with this line, nothing is said, in Seth's line, nothing is said about natural inventions or secular progress. But it's the continuing situation of redemption that's stressed. And it's the otherworldly attitude which is conveyed in the text. It includes groaning and a suffering, but also a service. This is so interesting in the name. So Abel is killed, and in his place, in the place of the dead one, comes Seth. He's appointed to stand in his place, which is a daunting thing already. But he has a son, and he names him Enosh. The name Enosh means man or mankind, plurally, but many of the commentators point out it comes from a root word which means weakness or suffering. So it's man and suffering. John Bunyan says that the name is basically man of sorrows. A man that's going to live miserable in this world for the sake and the cause of God. So Seth, by his very name of his child, he offered him up to suffer many hardships for the cause of God. The hardships of miseries and the blood of saints will make men who are otherwise heedless consider the gospel. 1 Peter tells us very clearly in chapter 3 how when people see that you're suffering for the righteousness' sake, they're going to ask you for an answer for the hope that lies within you. Paul's great suffering in 2 Corinthians, what ends up happening? People say, I don't understand why you're going through all this suffering. How many times have you been asked that as a Christian? Why do you go through it all? One of the greatest actual defenses, circumstantial and evidential, I agree, and so it's not a perfect defense, but one of the greatest defenses of Christianity is simply this. If it was a lie, if they were putting up this as a front, how could these disciples have gone through the persecution and to death that they did? Who does that? Who suffers for a lie? For a conspiracy? Jesus Christ says to his disciples, "Behold, I send you forth as lambs in the midst of wolves." In essence, Jesus gives his disciples the name Enosh. You are men to suffer for my sake. You will be acquainted with grief and miseries. But then notice, they began to call upon the name of the Lord. This is when they began to call on the name of the Lord. And there's a contrast in our narrative. It's drawing out for us. Cain is in contrast, or he's put over against Abel. And then Enoch, of Cain's descendants, is contrasted with Enosh, the first son of Seth. But the climax of the contrast comes in the seventh generation of both children, of Cain and Seth. The seventh generation of Cain is Lamech. Do you know who the seventh generation of Seth is? It's Enoch. Another Enoch, but this is Seth's Enoch, and he's the Enoch that you know of. He's the one that you're aware of. Who is Enoch? He's famous for one great thing. He walked with God and then was not. He did not have to die because he was walking with God. There's a supernatural element to it. It's not just he was a good, pious person, but there's something more than that. And what we're supposed to see, I believe, is that this points to the fact that we are to understand that where communion with God has been restored, there is deliverance from death bound to follow. Even in the early chapters of Genesis, with the seventh generation, you have Lamech, the death dealer. I'm going to boast about my death all day long. I'm going to kill anybody who even crosses paths with me. And then you have Enoch from Seth, who walks with God and then is no more. He's delivered from death. And then the people are calling upon the name of the Lord. Calvin points out that the calling on the name of the Lord, the invocation, is meant to convey full worship and not just prayer. But it shouldn't be overlooked that revivals start with fervent prayer and a crying out to God. And if you read your Bible, if you know your Psalms, they almost always start with a fervent prayer out of the cauldron, out of the fire. out of the contrast with the darkness of sin around you, and people crying out to God. This is what happened with the Apostle Paul. He was himself, he was the dark cauldron. The tiger of sin was in his heart, and he was seeking to kill everybody. But instead, God converted him. And then when God tells Ananias to go find Paul, he says, behold, what is he doing? What is Paul doing? The beginning of his conversion? Behold, he's praying. Acts chapter 9, verse 11. And Lord, have mercy on me is the first groans of a sanctified heart. Now, it's interesting, in the marginal note to the Hebrew, it says that this is when they began to call themselves by the name of the Lord. And you may be heard in my prayer in the start of this sermon that it's not just calling upon the name of the Lord, it's not just our prayer, it's calling ourselves by the name of the Lord. And I think both are really great. I don't know which one is most original, if the marginal note has it correct, or if calling upon the name of the Lord has it correct. Has massive implications for the flood and to wipe away this silly theory that the sons of God in the Bible are talking about angels and not the sons of Seth. But that would be something we'd get to if we get to Genesis chapter 6. And we're not there this morning. So here I just want to point out the contrast of Cain trying to make a name for himself and building a city, and the sons of Seth, they're not trying to make a name for themselves. They're taking on the name of God. They're submitting under the name of God. And if we desire a name, the love of God and His Word, the love of Christ and His truth, the love of His name is the way to get yourself a name. Remember what happened to the woman who brought the alabaster flasks full of costly ointment, spill it on Jesus? The disciples made fun of her, and they were upset. You could have sold this thing for so much and given it to the poor. Jesus said, you're going to always have the poor with you. But let me tell you this one awesome fact. Whenever the gospel is preached throughout the whole world, from to this day to the end of history, her name is going to be spoken of. So fascinating that it actually doesn't give her name in the text. Because it's not her name that's spoken of. It's her desire to be with the Lord. It's her calling upon the Lord. It's her being a servant of the Lord and serving others. It's beautiful. That's a name that's well gotten, and it's firm. It continues to the end. Now, where did this power to persevere come from? Was Seth just a good guy? Of course not. You know that's not true. It's God. He's faithful in preserving the seed of the woman while allowing the full darkness of the seed of the serpent to be exposed. Because it's good that we know what Christ has won for us. And Bob was talking this morning in Sunday school class about knowing for sure that you're forgiven of your sin by being specific with the confession of your sin. Knowing what Christ has won for you is always connected to knowing what He has saved you from. And knowing what He's reversed, and that's what I want to conclude on, this idea of what Jesus has reversed. Christ picks up, and we read it for our New Testament reading, Christ picks up Lamech's toast, his boast, not his toast. he picks up his boast, 70 times 7, but He reverses it. When the disciples ask Jesus, how many times should I forgive? Jesus says 70 times 7. Lamech was saying, with that phraseology, he was saying, I have endless anger, and I will never, ever let go of my anger. I will never let go of my anger. I'm always going to hold on to it. Endless anger, endless revenge. Do you know what Jesus is saying? The endless anger of human sin is going to be met by the endless love of God. Christ is going to reverse Lamech's boast of endless anger and revenge as the good shepherd with endless love and forgiveness of sin. That's why Jesus tells the parable right after that about forgiveness. And the point for us this morning, brothers and sisters, is forgive out of the endless forgiveness that you have been given.